Hallelujah. Okay, we're talking about the star of the wise men. The wise men's star. What was it? Everybody knows it was a UFO. What did they see? Yeah, an angel. That's what the Seventh-day Adventists say. They say that the star was the angels that sang for the shepherds when they went back up into heaven. They made a star. I don't know. Who knows? They might be right. What do they say?
They say that it was Satan.
Why?
Because they knew because Herod wanted to kill Jesus, right? So Satan sort of
put a star up there.
Three wise men where Jesus went by, showing a sign or whatever, so that the three wise men can go back to go back to tell Herod where the Savior was. And you know, we have to talk, well, why doesn't make sense because it says it's Jesus.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't the devil. I'm ingenious. Okay. Matthew chapter 2 and verse 2. Saying, this is what the wise men said, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him." I'm going to give you some possibilities. One of the more common ones is that there was a conjunction of the planet Jupiter with the planet Saturn in the constellation Pisces, which is the fish, which is known to apply to the Shemites, therefore the Hebrews, and that this particular conjunction pointed to the heralding of the birth of a great man. And it is said that this particular conjunction, and then within 1 year it would happen three times, that for it to have this conjunction three times in 1 year occurs only once every 800 years. And it is thought by some that it was happened at the birth of, they say, Adam, which is, I don't know, a little far-fetched maybe, Enoch, Moses, Cyrus, Christ, Charlemagne, and Luther. And who knows? They say that it occurred three times that year in 6 B.C., in May, in October, and December, and that it was joined by Mars in 5 B.C. Some say that this conjunction possibly brought to light another star that appeared in the center between these planets. And this was supposedly observed by Kepler in 1603. Possibly you've heard of Kepler, astronomer, 17th century. In 1603, he said it was a very radiant star. One of the problems with this, although this is a fairly common type of a supposition that this is what happened, one problem is that the conjunction never approaches within the double apparent diameter of the moon. In other words, if you put your finger, like your finger up in there, and the diameter of your finger, your little finger, would be about how close they would get together. But that is quite a close conjunction compared to how far they usually are apart. And when it would happen in Pisces, the fish, in the constellation of Pisces, that would give, therefore, an interpretation to the wise men. Now, before I go any further, let me just say this. The wise men were in the east. Now, here's the earth, and here's Bethlehem. Here's where Joseph and Mary were, okay? And the shepherds are out in the field with their sheep, you know, the woolly sheep. And here's the angels. You can't appreciate my drawings back there, I guess, can you? Anyway, the angels and the sheep, and there's Joseph and Mary. And way over here in the east were the wise men, okay? There's a wise man, I won't make two of them. And they saw his star in the east, possibly meaning One of two ways. Either that in the east they saw the star, or they actually saw the star towards the sun rising, because that's what east means. East means in their usage, it means the sun rising. And some say that that's where Pisces was at that point. It would be one that would be rising on the eastern side, the eastern hemisphere. And they saw his star. Now understand that what they saw was interpretive. It wasn't like a plane that has coming behind it, this is his star, you know, dragging across the sky. They saw the star. Now when you and I look up into the heavens at night, what do you see? Do you know many of the constellations? If you don't know many of the constellations, all it is just a mass of stars. It looks like somebody took a big shotgun and blew a hole in the black ceiling, you know, and the light's filtering through. That's what it looks like. But if you are an astronomer, the skies are totally different. Now remember, I mentioned that these men were not occultists, but they were interpreters of the stars. When you're an astronomer and you look into the heavens, it's a totally different picture. Have you ever looked at the picture of your teeth, the x-rays of your teeth with a dentist? And he says, oh boy, you got a cavity right there. And you look at that and you say, well, that didn't look any different than in all the rest of my teeth. If that's a cavity, then I got them there, 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 and there. And he says, no, you got one right here. So you don't have any over here. You're not trained. See, you're not trained to see that. It takes training in order to perceive that. And like those that deal with x-rays, there's training that's involved to really understand what will make a thing look a certain way in an x-ray. Okay? Same way at the stars. You know, when an astronomer looks at the heavens, first of all, he's got lines that cross the heavens. He's got the median, and the meridian, I mean. He's got the meridian. The meridian line is going right over the center of the heavens, and, or however that is. Not the center, but it's on an angle from the earth. It's on an angle from the earth. You've got the north, and then you've got the meridian, and then, which would be 90 degrees to that, and you've got the heavens lined out. And then in the heavens, you have in the certain quadrants, you have, you know, over here you've got a bear, and over here you've got your scorpion, you know, and over here you've got all the other ones. I better quit my drawing, but you know, you've got all these different shapes and sizes and everything, and they all fit in certain quadrants, you know, at certain positions. Okay? That's what they see in the heavens. And each one of those has a meaning. Each one of those has a name and a meaning. And so if you're looking at one of them, and you know, and I'll be reading some more information to you here, but if you knew that this was Virgo, the Virgin, and that she held in her lap the child, Coma, the Virgin child, and was held in her lap, and that night, this was right on the meridian, let's say. This is one of the examples that they give. And if the line came across on the meridian, and one of the planets, and the planets in their particular orbit ended up right there in the middle, and it happened on a certain night, you would interpret that as there was a birth. Because of the dissection of lines, the traveling of the planets, and the position in which they appeared. Or if the planets are moving all around, and then on a certain night, they have a conjunction in a particular constellation, that would be interpreted to you as something. If you knew what the planets were, and so forth. Okay? Now, these men studied they studied the stars every night. I mean, they were watching every night. Watching. And so it wasn't an unknown thing to them. So here's a possibility, Jupiter and Saturn. I'll give you a little bit more information on that in just a moment. One thing is that in the Greek it says his star, aster, A-S-T-E-R, aster, it's a star, that's what it means. It does not say astron, A-S-T-R-O-N, which points to other, you know, like planets and other things in the heavens. It didn't say that, it said aster, a star. So some say, well, that means that had to be something different. It had to be maybe a star that appeared between the conjunction. It would have to be that. But not necessarily, because the planets also could have been called aster, some say. You know, so there's question as to just exactly what it is here. Let me just say that after I get all done with the information I've given you, we still don't really know what they saw. In the Chinese astronomical tables, they there reveal a very radiant star that appeared suddenly in 4 BC, sometime in the year 4 BC. But the information is real scanty, and some feel, or most feel actually, that it was a comet. So we don't really know. There's another possibility, that is the last, that in the constellation Virgo. Now, here's another possibility. This one is given by people that believe in the December 25th birthday. And they say that the last week of December, that Virgo, the Virgin Mother, was just rising on the Eastern Hemisphere. And that 9 months earlier, at spring equinox, Virgo was on the meridian with a line across her bosom, and also Coma, which is the infant seed, was on a meridian that same night. That the meridian was on her bosom and also on the Coma. And also, there supposedly was a very bright star, visible even in the daytime, that appeared approximately 125 years before Christ, seen by Hipparchus, and it disappeared about 150 years after Christ, seen by Ptolemy. And it was in the head of Coma and on meridian that same night. And, you know, how to prove all these things is not a total exact science, believe me. There are some things that are still questionable. We do know that the heavens stand as a witness. And we do know that the stars are for signs. In Genesis 1 and verse 14, God, when He created the stars, He said, they shall be for signs. And for seasons, and for days, and for years. So you'll be able to judge times, and there will be signs by the stars. God is the one who has the constellations in His control, not man. God is the one who gave the original 12 signs. They don't belong to Zoroaster. They don't belong to astrologers. They don't belong to those that believe in horoscopes. They belong to God. He's the one that gives them their proper and rightful interpretation, not man. Some feel that it was possibly a miraculous manifestation. You know, it was something, but it looked like a star. Miraculous or not, it looked like a star. It was in the heavens. And when they saw it, then they prepared for their journey, and then they took off to worship Christ. And they evidently didn't, you know, either was not seen it again, and it possibly, this is what to some would make it appear that it was a conjunction, because when they were in Bethlehem, all of a sudden they saw it again, and they were shocked. They saw it again. See? They were surprised. And that would tend to lend credence to the possibility of a conjunction. Something that there was a conjunction, a certain place, a certain time, and they interpreted it as the birth of the King of the Jews. And then as time went on, of course, the conjunction was split and so forth. Possibly it came together again at that time. Except we're going to see that when it came together this time, that it actually went right before them and stood over where the Christ child was. And so that brings us into other possibilities. And therefore, it was interpretive. That's what we need to remember. It was an interpretive star. It was something that would be interpreted as the King of the Jews because of where it appeared and how it appeared and whatever conjunction may have been there or not. Now, there have been several that have discussed as to what it might be. Let me give you one man. His name is Ernest Martin of the Biblical Research Foundation in Pasadena, California. And through the use of a projector at an observatory, what they do is they find the shape of the stars, and they follow these the day patterns, and they say that they can give you what the heavens look like at any day in history. And they can project it to the future also. Because the stars are stayed in the same shape. It's the same constellations. It's the same way it looked when Abraham looked at them. They looked the same. And so there's a pattern that is followed by the years, the cycle of the years, and the spinning of the earth and all of that. This is what they say. For now, he comes up with quite a different dating than I do. He says that previously many have felt that a triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn was assumed to have been the star the wise men saw. But now, for historical reasons, which have nothing to do with the planetarium, the date has been changed to 3 or 2 B.C. It ties with an astronomical phenomenon that is more spectacular than the triple conjunction between Jupiter and Saturn in 7 B.C. We're looking at astronomical events that are even more exciting. Two close conjunctions of Jupiter and Venus, and a triple conjunction of Jupiter and the star Regulus, said Moseley. Most of these conjunctions took place in the constellation of Leo, which has always been associated with the Jews. These spectacular celestial displays of planets and stars appearing to run into each other in the sky had for many years been in the charts for the year 3 to 2 B.C., but no one ever looked at them because it was believed that Jesus was born before that year. And that's held on the common death of Herod in 4 B.C. But then he says this, Martin's research says that Herod did not die in 4 B.C., but only suffered a political downfall. And, you know, all I can say is this is what he found, and I'm not sure what his research is. By carefully tracing all the known events surrounding Herod's death, Martin has gained acceptance from biblical history experts that Herod died in 1 B.C., thus pushing forward the date for Christ's birth to about 3 B.C. Martin conjectured that Jesus was born sometime in the late summer of 2 B.C. He says shepherds wouldn't have been in their fields watching their flocks at night during the winter. And by the time the Magi had observed and interpreted the celestial signs and traveled from Jerusalem, Jesus would have been several months old, says Martin. He refers to the wise men bringing their gifts to a house and not to a manger. So Martin shows that on December 25th, 2 B.C., as viewed from Earth, Jupiter began its westward motion, reversing its normal eastern direction against the background of the stars. This made Jupiter appear to become stopped or stationary in the middle of the abdomen region of the constellation of Virgo, the Virgin. The wise men, observing the scene from Jerusalem at their ordinary pre-dawn time for heavenly observations, would have seen Jupiter stopped over Bethlehem, 68 degrees above the southern horizon. This is what he states in his book. A significant aspect of the celestial events of 3 to 2 B.C. is the interpretation the wise men would have given them. We feel confident that they were astrologers from Persia. According to astrological interpretation, Jupiter is the king planet, Venus is the mother planet, and Regulus is the king star. So he feels that it was two close conjunctions of Jupiter and Venus, which are the king and the mother stars, and then a triple conjunction of Jupiter and the star Regulus. And Regulus is the king star, excuse me, and Jupiter is the king planet. Okay. So that's one. That's another possibility.
What's the name of his book?
Martin, his book? Let me think. Let me see if I've got it here. This was given in the Gazette Times, Corvallis, Oregon, December 24th, 1980. The book is entitled The Birth of Christ Recalculated. The Birth of Christ Recalculated by Dr. Ernest Martin. And I would assume it probably was written not too long before 1980. So the publishing date sometime in the 70s. That's what is said, yes, is that that's the possibility to be able to do that. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not that studied on it, so I don't really know how sure that is. Here's another one. This came out of the Kent Valley paper in 1981, December 25th. And talking again about the star. He meant, in this particular one, they do mention Ernest Martin. And Martin's theory, what he comes up with. Then he also mentions another one, Carolyn Beeler, an artist in New Haven, Connecticut, recently discovered an overlooked painting of two apple trees in a Roman catacomb. With the help of a Yale astronomer, she discovered that the position of the apples on one tree marked the position of the stars in the constellation Aquila, with one exception. The painting showed a mysterious extra star that is not visible today. The other tree in the picture showed the positions of the stars in the heavens in the spring of 5 B.C. Miss Beeler has reasoned that the extra star was a star that varies in brightness and was only briefly visible during the spring of 5 B.C. She said it was the star of Bethlehem. Her theory attracted the attention of the Pope John Paul II's personal astronomer, and last year she was invited to the Pope's summer palace. So if you want to go to Pope's Summer Palace, you see a star too. Find a star. Also in here, it brings out a little bit more information about Martin. Here he says that, according to this, Jesus would have been born in September of 3 BC and would have been about 15 months old when the wise men arrived with their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And that Jupiter, it says, first of all, there was the conjunction of Jupiter and Venus with Regulus. And this happened three times in the constellation of Leo. And then later, Jupiter came to rest in the constellation Virgil, the Virgin. And so it was talking about the birth and so forth of the child. And Jupiter came to stop right in the middle of the abdomen of Virgil, right where the Virgin would be carrying a child. So forth. That's another interesting information. Now here's another one. This is from the PI. This is also 1980, December 25th. Just a couple of snatches out of this one. This is from Matledge. This is from Tempe, Arizona. Dan Matledge, Arizona State's Planetarium Coordinator. And he is a Arizona State University researcher. And this is what he came up with. He said, Mary and Joseph came to Bethlehem for a census that occurred in 8 B.C. Using these and other clues, Matledge concludes that Christ was born between 8 and 4 B.C., with 6 B.C. the most likely date. In fact, it's likely that the December 25th was not the time of his birth, but rather corresponded with a Roman pagan festival called Saturnalia, and so forth. He rules out a meteor. He rules out other possibilities. But he concludes that the most likely explanation of the Christmas star is the appearance of a tight triangular conjunction of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars in the western sky that set so close to the sun that it was difficult to see unless someone like an astrologer was looking for it. And it was a sign to astrologers that a king was to be born. So that's his thought. Okay, let me give you one from the Times. And I don't know why all these came out, but Thursday, December 25th, 1980, in the Times. Now, this is another one. This is from a guy from Seattle. Tom Caldwell, a Seattle amateur astronomer, has been collecting information on the triple conjunction of the two planets of Jupiter and Saturn. And he said they'll draw together again on March 4th and July 23rd, and that's in 1981. The event, which also happened in the year 7 B.C., is Caldwell's favorite explanation for the Star of Bethlehem. He says this, the wise men were astrologers from Persia. Their business was to look for prophecies and other information in the movement of the stars. In those days, the planets were considered stars, although with strange habits of wandering among the other stars. The conjunction of the planets probably carried a special message to the astrologers of the day. Saturn was known as the protector of Israel. Jupiter was the royal planet. Furthermore, the conjunction occurred while the planets were in the constellation Pisces, known then as the House of the Hebrews. And the first of the three conjunctions would have been in the eastern sky before dawn on May 29th, 7 B.C. Okay. Now, did I give you... he's an amateur astronomer. Okay. And so if it had been born in May, the planets would have pulled close together twice more during their journey on October 3rd and on December 4th, all in the same year. And then they came to find out about this king. All of the three conjunctions in 7 B.C. would have been in the Pisces constellation. Triple conjunctions, all in the same constellation, occur no more than once in about 800 years, Caldwell said. And that is what will happen in the next 7 months, except the triple conjunction will be in another constellation, Virgo. It will provide a chance to see almost exactly what the wise men saw almost 1,988 years ago. That's what he said in 1980. There is doubt about it, and Caldwell goes on and gives some other information. Talks about the date of Herod's birth and so forth. Historians tend to rule out a comet or supernova as an explanation for the star in the east. It seems logical that such an event would have been widely noticed. Yet Herod's court had not heard of the star when the wise men arrived, and skilled observers in both the Middle East and China did not record any such event. So it was probably not a comet or a supernova because that had been seen by others. So undoubtedly, it was those that had the inside information on the interpretation of a star that would be considered the king of the Jews. And that would fit real well with those who had had influence from Daniel and had been followers of the writings of probably Moses and Jeremiah and others, and then would be watching the stars and interpreting what was happening in the heavens. So, what was it exactly? I don't know. But it was interpretive. It was something that was interpretive because of, I'm sure of this, because of the constellations of the heavens and their positioning, and how undoubtedly the planets, which would be moving, would cause some sort of conjunction or whatever. There may have been another star that came to light, like some have said. But see, there's just a lot of conjecture in it, and there may come more exacting and more provable information in the future. Now, what happened? After they saw the star, they came to worship him. Verse 3, when Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. This word troubled means perplexed. You can imagine how perplexing it was. They didn't know a thing about it. Here come these Gentiles, not rabbis, not Pharisees, not Sadducees, not priests, Gentiles, rich, outstanding, unique, a group of them, coming from the east to worship the king of the Jews. Can you imagine that? They were perplexed. And all the city, of course, would notice such a group of men coming into the city. And again, particularly because these were Gentiles. They were not Jews. They were Gentiles. And they weren't proselytes either, undoubtedly. So, verse 4. And when he, that is Herod, had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. He demanded. So he wants to know where this Messiah. So, king of the Jews, he understood it was the Messiah. And notice he demanded. And that's because Herod was a very jealous man, a very fearful man, paranoid, beyond belief, murderer of all those that would be a threat to his throne. And he feared of losing his position. Much like Nebuchadnezzar also, who feared also himself before God. And Belshazzar, who saw the handwriting on the wall, and he feared. Because they were not established by God, and therefore they feared. Now, it's interesting to note, he asks of the scribes and the Pharisees and the different chief priests, and asks them of where Christ should be born, and they knew. Verse 5, and they said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah. For out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. So they knew that he'd be born in Bethlehem. But we don't ever hear of them worshiping Christ. We don't ever hear of them seeking him out. We don't ever hear of them going down to worship him. They had the information, but they wanted to be exalted by their knowledge in front of Herod. They wanted position. Who cares if some child? They just want to rule. Besides that, it wasn't done in Jerusalem. Besides that, it wasn't done notably. So, who cares? And they weren't the ones that went down to worship. Then Herod, when he had privily, this is verse 7, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. Privily, that is secretly. So he's not going to let anybody know. He wants to get together with these wise men privately and find out when they saw the star so that he can ascertain when this child was born. Because a man is afraid. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search diligently for the young child. So see, this is the issue. The wise men, they didn't know where he was born. They just knew he was king of the Jews. So the king of the Jews is born. Probably should have been born in Jerusalem, but evidently he wasn't. So the chief priest said, well, the Messiah, who will be the king of the Jews, he's born in Bethlehem. So Herod says he was born in Bethlehem. Go down to Bethlehem. Find him. Diligently search and find the child. And when you have found him, bring me word again that I may come and worship him also. With a hatchet in one hand. But he didn't say that. When they had heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them. Now the word and lo means and behold, and it's exclamation. Behold, the star which they saw in the east went before them. It kept leading them forward till it came and stood over where the young child was. Now, to us, that sounds like a cloud or something, you know, just above the ground a little ways. But to an astronomer, it could be in the heavens and do that. And, yeah, it really is amazing. Now, tradition says that the way it happened is that it stood exactly directly over that house, and you could tell by looking in the well. Because the well is still, the water is still, it's like a mirror. You look down in there, and whatever you'd see at the bottom would be absolutely directly above you, because you can't dig a well at an angle. It falls in. You have to dig exactly straight down. And by the time you look straight down a well, that funnels down your vision. And then by the time you're looking back up the well, it's funneled even more, so that just a slight movement of your head and that star goes out of sight, see? And so if you could look in that well and see it right in the middle, the star, it would be directly above you. And so they say that tradition says that's how they knew. And it's also interesting, although a sextant, and to my knowledge, they didn't use those particularly, but they used systems like that back at that time. They could actually plot their position on any place on the earth by the use of the stars, by knowing the time, by knowing the day, you know, that it is of the year. You can judge by the stars within, and I'm not sure how close it gets. I read somewhere it was within something like a mile or a quarter mile, half a mile, something like that. I mean, it's pretty close. They've got instruments now that through the use of the stars, you can judge where you are within a few yards, anywhere on the face of the earth. You can judge that closely by the angles of the stars and all of that to your position, and depending on the time and depending on the year and the day of the year. So that's really intriguing, isn't it? And so maybe there was some other method that they used. But it was a star, and it's called again a star. Now, I don't know if God would have done something miraculous at this point, but evidently it kept moving them forward. Now, I don't think that means year by year, or month by month, or week by week. I'm quite sure it means that night. So we've got something that's moving a whole lot faster than a planet would be in the heavens. And so evidently, a miraculous manifestation. Now, God led Israel by night by a pillar of fire. And so I suppose he could lead these wise men that knew how to interpret the stars by what would let them know where to go. And it led them forward, and it came and stood over where the young child was. Now, see, that's the interesting thing. That whatever this was able to bring them right to the very house where Christ was. And they were able to find that exact place. There may be a way that as they walked along, that star would give them notice of yes or no. You know, it may have been that sort of type of thing. We don't know exactly. So it must have been something miraculous in my mind. That's the only way I can see that it could be interpreted. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. Because, see, they didn't see it any longer. They'd seen it in the east. They knew the Christ child had been born. And they hadn't been seeing it. They came and they journeyed over to worship the Christ child. And now, all of a sudden, it appeared again. And because of the position and the moving of it, it kept leading them forward because of its movement. And it stopped right over where the young child was. It's evidently what we're seeing here. And when they were coming to the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother and fell down and worshipped him. And when they'd opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Look at these men. This has always kind of stunned me. Here are these men. What do they owe this little child? Obviously, there was a devoutness and a reverence, and they were locked into what God was saying through the stars. And they had a reverence for what was happening in the heavens. And when they saw God speak to them so specifically, so directly, they reverenced it. And they came to worship this Christ, worship this child. And notice it's not in a stable, as I mentioned, it's in a house. Now, the gifts were gold and frankincense and myrrh. Gold represents, actually all three of them represent aspects of the nature of Christ Jesus. Gold is used throughout Scripture to represent deity, the nature of God that is without tarnish, without fail, doesn't change. The frankincense, it was commonly used for kings, it was white. came from flowers. And it was representative of Christ's kingly position, his righteousness, his robe of righteousness. It also points to his mediatorship. The myrrh, it was a resin coming from a tree that would be either the bark would be stripped, or it would be, as it were, wounded. And it would flow forth of itself. It was used for embalming the dead. It was a preservative. And it also had a very strong odor, pleasant odor. And it would represent Christ's humanity, the man of sorrows, and the sweet smell that came forth from his sufferings, and the preservation in his death. And so we see in Christ, actually, the three basic aspects of his life and ministry. And that is, as man, the Son of Man. And as God, the Father dwelling within him. And as the mediator, the King, the one who is made Lord, to stand between us and God, and to, as it were, intercede for us to the Father. It was an Oriental custom that you never visited a superior without a gift. And therefore, they are recognizing and acknowledging Jesus Christ as superior to them, these rich, wise men. In Psalm 72 and verse 10, sort of an interesting scripture here. Psalm 72:10, it's talking about the millennium. It says, "The kings of Tarshish and of the Isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all kings shall fall down before him. All nations shall serve him. For he shall deliver the needy when he cries, the poor also in him that has no helper." Now see, that hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen in the millennium. And it's a prophecy about Christ. And here we see it typified in these Gentiles as the kings of the earth bringing their presence to the Christ and honoring him for being the Messiah and the deliverer of the people of God, and for all people, actually, dying for the sins of the whole world. And then verse 12, "And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way." So God spoke to them. God let them know. They were in fellowship with God. I mean, there was an openness to God, and there was an honoring of God that they had in their own hearts, and they received it of God, and they went into back to their land another way. Probably they just went south. They probably just kept going south, away from Herod and away from Jerusalem. That's probable. Although there was a road from Bethlehem that you could skirt Jerusalem going over to the east, down by the Dead Sea. So they possibly went over towards the Dead Sea and then up, back up into their country. "And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, and take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word. For Herod will seek the young child to destroy him." That's possibly the same night. The wise men came by night. They had to follow the star. And they worshipped him. It's possibly that same night. We don't know. Possibly the same night that they were warned in a dream, too, to leave. And if it wasn't the same night, it certainly wasn't long after that. Because Herod wasn't going to just stick around waiting for this thing to, you know, move of itself. He was in touch. And when he heard that the wise men had not honored his request, believe me, he got on the move. "And when they were departed," let's see, "And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt," very possibly that very same night. And, you know, realize that they didn't have just oodles and oodles of possessions. I mean, they came from Nazareth, traveled by donkey, down to Jerusalem and stayed there. I mean, how much did they bring with them? And it wasn't common for them to have a lot. Even though he was a carpenter, he would have probably made or bought other tools while he was down there and begun his trade again. And so he just took off out of there probably that same night. Departed into Egypt and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Which is a prophecy out of Hosea 11 and verse 1. And an interesting prophecy at that, because in the context it's referring to the nation of Israel and evidently referring to their exodus out of Egypt. But there's some other indicators there that it's not quite that. And then we see that the Holy Ghost picked up that prophecy and applied it to Jesus, who went down into Egypt. And then God called him out of Egypt later, called his son out, of course, through Joseph. Okay. So we can see quite a movement here in Jerusalem and in Bethlehem in short order. And God confirming His word through dreams. Verse 16. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. And then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, In Ramah was there a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted because they are not. Now tradition says that there were 14,000 children slain. And I'm sure that's way too many. 14,000, that's a lot of infants. It was a horrible thing. So horrible that there's even a prophecy taken out of Jeremiah 31 and verse 15 concerning this incident. But you see, Bethlehem was small. It probably, today, numbers about 4,000. It is thought that it numbered even less at that time. So it's not just a huge city. It's a village, possibly numbering 3,000, maybe 2,000. If we take it as 4,000, let's say children that are 2 years old and under, that is 23 months on down. How many, what's the percentage of a population that would have, that would be 23 months and under? What's the population? What's the percentage? If you were to say it was 10%, that would be really high. Now, Community Chapel, we have a fairly high percentage of young children because of young families and getting married and all of that. So it's a little bit higher percentage, but ours is not even 10% in that age group. It's less than that. And if it was 10%, that would be 400. If it was 10%. And it says Bethlehem and the coasts thereof. Now, the coasts, what they would commonly do is they'd have little groups of homes, you know, just like farmhouses that you see sometimes out and about. They have little groups of homes sometimes out and around a city. So there'd be a few homes, like 4 or 5 homes over here and 2 or 3 homes over there. And they'd be kind of joined together out in the fields, you know. And so people, some of them would live out in the fields. Then there'd be the city. And so evidently the soldiers went into the homes and killed all the children in Bethlehem, home after home after home. You can see the loud lamenting, the horrible things. And see, Herod did things like this. He was a horrible, horrible man. Demon-possessed, very clearly. I would say, now, like, is there 400 in the surrounding area? That would be really a high percentage. It's possible. If it was a smaller percentage, let's say if it was 3%, which is common in a lot of societies, that'd be about 120. 5%, that'd be 200+. So I would say, you know, I would say it'd be anywhere between 200 and 400 would be probably about the right number. But that's still a lot of children. And realize probably the death rate gets higher as they get a little older. There's probably a lot of infants that die young. I was interested to talk to a brother that was at a real old, up here in the Green River Gorge, at an old cemetery. And it was, the dates on the tombstones go back to the 1890s, and it's right in that era. And he said, all the tombstones, there were a lot of children and nobody over 35. The oldest one they found was 35 years old. Because the death rate was really high in that. And I was surprised to find out that in the 17th century in this country, that the death rate of children was over 60%. So any woman having children would know that her children would die within the first year over 60%. Over half of her children would die in the first year of their birth. And so death was just common. I mean, you just saw a lot of people dying. And the percentage of those that would grow past the young age, if I remember right, they said was something like 20%. It was a small percentage. And for instance, Susanna Wesley, that you've possibly heard a lot of because she raised Charles and John Wesley and others, and she had 19 or 16 children, I can't remember, but see, only 6 of them lived to adulthood. And so at any one time, she wasn't raising all that many children because so many of them died when they were young. She had 19 or 16 children, whichever it was, but only 6 of them lived to adulthood. So there was a lot of deaths in young. See, we don't realize how common that would be because we got so much protection shots and other things in this nation. So anyway, it could be even lower than that, is what I'm getting at. It could be even lower than that. There may not be that many. Although, probably percentage-wise, it'd be more at that age in some senses because they'd be dying later, so it's hard to know. 200 to 400. This prophecy is really interesting. I want to look at it. It says, in Ramah was there a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning. Now, Ramah is a city approximately 5 miles north of Jerusalem. It's in full sight of Jerusalem. And it's right on the route north out of Jerusalem. And this is where the captives were assembled by Nebuchadnezzar when he destroyed Jerusalem and took so many thousands captive back into Babylon. And so in Ramah, everybody found out who had been killed. In Ramah, you found out how much of your family was left, and so many had been slaughtered, and it was great wailing and mourning. So Ramah was a city where there was so much weeping and mourning by the Jewish people after the destruction by Babylon that in Ramah there was a voice heard. And yet, this was a prophecy. Now it says there, Rachel, weeping for her children, and would not be comforted because they are not. Now Rachel was long time dead. She was the mother of Benjamin. She was the mother of Joseph. And, interesting enough, Benjamin is the area in which Jerusalem is. In other words, it's the tribal allotment. Jerusalem is in the area that has been allotted to Benjamin. And so is Ramah. In fact, we've often thought of Jerusalem being in Judah. It's not. It's in Benjamin. There's a small area. You've got the Sea of Galilee and then the Dead Sea. And Benjamin covered an area, just a small area. Judah covered a large area. Simeon covered an area like that. You know, I think Ephraim covers a big area like that. You know, and all the different tribes have their inheritances. Jerusalem is right there, just inside of the area of Benjamin. Just inside the area of Benjamin. And then north of that, where Ramah was, would be more so into the tribal allotment of Benjamin. And so Rachel is the mother of Benjamin. And so Rachel is weeping for her children. Rachel is weeping for her children. And so it's a typical, it's a representative, it's a figure of speech. And Rachel also was the first love and the chief love of Israel. Of Israel. And therefore, and it's interesting that Rachel also was probably buried near Bethlehem, between Bethlehem and Hebron, somewhere in there. Some say more closer to Bethlehem or Hebron, but somewhere in that area was where Rachel was buried under an oak. Because when she gave birth to Benjamin, she died at his birth. And so here is Rachel representing the real love of God, the tender one of Israel, the one that cares for her young, and she is having her young slaughtered, and she is weeping. And that's what's happening. Real horrible thing. Now some would even want to say, well, Joseph should have done something about that. And really, isn't Joseph kind of responsible? About the death of these children. I'm giving forth a philosophy that has been foisted on many people. You know, we're responsible for all sorts of things that you're not responsible for. And that you should feel bad about things that you had nothing to do with. And that you should have to pay for things that are nowhere near your control or anything of that sort. The one who obviously was responsible was Herod. Joseph obeyed God and got the Christ child out of there. Joseph obeyed God. Now, other things could have been done. God could have done all kinds of things. He could have struck Herod dead right then. But he didn't do it. He rather chose to get Jesus out of there. And that's up to God and his wisdom, what he will do. Joseph was led of God. And Joseph is not responsible for other men's sin. He shouldn't say, well, God will protect Christ, even though Herod does send down his armies. We'll just let Herod know that this is the Christ, and then it's up to God to protect the Christ. But that's not how God moved. God moved him out of there and said, you get. And so he obeyed and got out. You see, you can't double guess God and take false responsibility for other men's sin. For other men's sin. Those that have been tortured. I was reading by years back, Karlan Popoff. He said that the ones that were married had it much worse because the tormentors would often use their families as a tool. They'd say, if you would just confess, or if you would just submit, then we wouldn't torture your wife. We wouldn't torture your kids. Look, they're destitute, and they'd bring in pictures, sometimes mock pictures. Sometimes they'd even bring in the family. Sometimes there were actual physical beatings in front of the man saying, just recant. Just tell the truth. The truth is that you're a spy. And that all this Christian preaching is rather deception and heretical. Just tell the truth. Just sign right here. And if you don't, we're going to continue to torture your wife. Tremendous pressure put on them. And someone would just break under it. And you can't really blame them. You can't really blame them. But really, whose responsibility is it? If his wife gets tortured, whose responsibility is it? Is it his responsibility for doing that which is right? No. It's his torturer's responsibility. But see, the devil will try to use that as a leverage to try to break people's will. The point is that in the saving of Christ, Joseph was being obedient and submissive unto God. And that the greater sin now falls upon Herod. The man who had shed much innocent blood now adds yet more of this. And after this happened, this is what brought the end of his life. Because it was right after this that he got this horrible disease that brought him into a great torment, and later he died from it. We'll be talking about that real shortly. Verse 19, but when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life. They are dead, probably referring to Herod and his soldiers and those that were fulfilling his demands for the murder of these children, 200. And he arose and took the young child and his mother and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go thither. Now that was in Judea. Nazareth wasn't in Judea. Nazareth was in Galilee. He was headed back to Bethlehem. So he was afraid when he found Archelaus was there. Notwithstanding, being warned of God in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee. Now, what's the problem with Archelaus? Archelaus was as bad, almost, or even worse in some ways, than his father, Herod the Great. He was dethroned after 10 years because he was such an obnoxious and cruel and wicked man. He killed 3,000 Jews even before the Roman government established him in the throne, because he knew they would, and so he decided to make the way clear. He was bloodthirsty, wicked, full of avarice and vice of all kinds, and very cruel. He thrown after 10 years. So knowing that, he turned aside into Galilee after another dream by God. Okay, let's go. Have you turned in Matthew 3:10 yet? Friday. Okay. Pardon me? Have you read commentary on it? Well, come up here. I'll give you a couple points. And then when you're in the library, you see somebody else laboring under Matthew 3:10. Look and see what they're doing. Thank you.